This message is sponsored by Greenlight. With school out, summer is the perfect time to teach our kids real-world money skills they'll use forever. Greenlight is a debit card and the number one family finance and safety app used by millions of families, helping kids learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely. Parents can send their kids money and track their spending and saving, while kids build money confidence and skills in fun ways. Start your risk-free Greenlight trial today at greenlight.com/iHeart. That's greenlight.com/iHeart.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Dan Flores. The book is Wild New World, the epic story of animals and people in America. The large predators, the large mammals, mastodons, dire wolves, saber-toothed tigers, removed, opens up what Dan introduces me to call niches. And those niches have replacements. This is a profound turn for the hunter-gathering groups, societies that spread across North America. Dan, the filling of these niches, that's part of a story that's ongoing through all of these epochs that we're talking about, that there's a balance, and when that balance is disturbed, nature seeks stability again. Is that the way to read this, Professor?
Well, that is certainly a way to read it. I would say that whenever a niche opens where there is, for example, the possibility of grazing on immense grasslands that once had been home to mammoths and other grazing creatures, what tends to happen in response, and what happened in North America 10,000 years ago, is that an animal that is left, like the bison, is going to expand into that niche that's been abandoned by other creatures. And this is when we see the huge population explosion of the American bison into the millions that we think of in our last 400 or 500 years of history. And it's a smaller animal than the bison that had preceded it in the Pleistocene and are now extinct. In fact, it's an animal that probably is shaped by the presence of human hunting and predation. So it has anthropogenic origins even in its natural history. And in that 10,000 year period after the Pleistocene is over, from 10,000 years ago down to at a time when old worlders began arriving in America, is this kind of marvelous period of a vastly long time when native people, most of them in the beginning of this 10,000 years, hunter-gatherers, although agriculture does emerge in the last 2,000 years or so of that 10,000, who spread across North America and develop a set of ecological adaptations and economies that allow them to actually preserve the diversity, the wonderful richness of the remaining animals that had survived the Pleistocene in North America. And they preserve it down to the time when old worlders arrived 500 years ago, remarkably with only in that 10,000 year period, only one extinction. There is a flightless sea duck on the Pacific coast that becomes extinct during this 10,000 year period, but that is the sole extinction over 10,000 years. So it's a remarkable kind of story to know about.
Yes, you make the point that the hunter-gatherers, and there's an illustration in Dan's book to show you where the hunter-gatherers were. The largest number was either in the Southwest or in the Northeast, 715,000 in the Northeast, 908,000 in the Southwest, was still a predator's economy. And the predation, however, seemed to find a balance, because what is the rule, Professor, that populations grow to the limits and beyond of their resources? Is that the rule?
Well, that's the common story, at least in human history. But what seems to have prevailed in North America over this 10,000 year span is that people understood that, especially with a hunting and gathering economy, what you need is a vast open landscape where wild creatures, birds, reptiles, mammals can survive well. And so they tend to very consciously try to keep their population levels low enough that they don't stress the populations of the animals they depend on. So one of the remarkable things about this period of time is that even after the introduction of agriculture, as I mentioned, which is in the last couple of thousand years of this 10,000 year span, the human population in North America never goes over about 5 million people. And that's what that map that I try to that I provide in the book tries to convey. I mean, this is in a part of the world where north of the Rio Grande, north of Mexico, including the United States and Canada today, we have nearly 400 million people living here. But these people for 10,000 years kept their population under 5 million. And that's one of the keys that enabled them to maintain this biological diversity.
Another joy of Dan's book is Poverty Point in the Mississippi floodplain. This, of course, requires you to accept the fact that hunter-gathering also has the ability to maintain large urban centers. You've been there, Dan. What does it look like, Poverty Point?
Well, you can tell when you're there that a piece of it has been washed away by the Mississippi River. It's in northeastern Louisiana. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And what it is one of these great mound-building cities that actually preceded the construction of pyramids in Mesoamerica. I think when I was growing up in Louisiana and finding these remnant mounds, I always assumed that this was a copy of the pyramid culture of Mesoamerica. But in fact, these mounds preceded those in time, and they give us some indication that people who were hunters and gatherers were able to actually aggregate into particular locations. This happened to be on the banks of the Mississippi River, so they were clearly taking advantage of the resources of the river itself and the trade possibilities up and down the river. And they built these wonderful mounds that largely celebrated the animals that they thought of as sacred. So one of the mounds there, probably the most famous one, is called Bird Mound. It's probably a mound that was intended originally to be a replica of a predatory bird, because as carnivores and predators, humans have always identified with predators. At least we have, until we invented herding and began to dislike predators very much. But that's sort of what it looks like. It's a remarkable sight.
Also in this 10,000 years, the hunter-gathering societies, the cultures, the villages had a relationship that is only described as poetic and spiritual, with two particular animals in mind, the coyotes and the ravens. What was coyote to in this 10,000 years?
Well, coyote in a lot of ways, an early, he and raven both, and I mentioned several others beside those, although this chapter is called Ravens and Coyotes America. They were the early deities of North American history. The stories that we tell about them that have been preserved down to the present time constitute the oldest literature in North American history, some of these stories going back 10,000 years or so. And these animals were, in many ways, stand-in avatars for humans. As deities, they're not perfect gods, the way many of the deities that come out of the Middle East, for example, appear to be. These are deities that humans are able to identify with because they're subject to all the lusts and all the desires and all the things that make us fully rounded human beings. And so those stories tend to convey creatures that are very familiar and almost humorous in their lessons. We often think of them as tricksters, but I've argued in this book that the actual circumstance is the tricks involved in the stories about them are really explanations of human nature. The reason tricks work is because of the particular foibles that we possess as human beings. So they're our most ancient gods.
In this 10,000 years, animals, as we describe them here, the wild animals, were kin to the hunter-gatherers. And there was a ongoing conversation, so much so that you tell one story where a buffalo is killed and then recreates or refashions himself as a buffalo ghost. So the terrain must have been filled with animals you've killed, animals who are watching you. There was no sharp distinction between Homo sapiens and the buffalo.
I think that is actually a very old idea in human history. It probably dates to times even deeper in history than the Neanderthals. It may well go back to the emergence of early hominids in Africa, that human beings and other creatures around us are the same, that we're not different. We humans are not exceptional. And one of the arguments that I use to make that point that is continuously present from ancient times down through this 10,000 year period we're talking about is that many of the images that we have from ancient times, say, for example, the wonderful Paleolithic art in Western Europe in places like Lascaux and Altamira and Chauvet Cave, that art always portrays animals that anthropologists refer to as therianthropes. And what they are part lion, part human, part bison, and part human. The idea is that humans are not exceptional, that we are part of the same kinship web. And Native people in America very eloquently and poetically conveyed this sentiment in their ceremonies, their stories, and in the kind of respect they had for the animals around them. So that, as they described it, whenever for some reason the animals were difficult to find, when buffalo were difficult to hunt, you did ceremonies to reassure them that humans thought of themselves and buffalo as kin. And at that point, the animals came dancing, the animals reemerged.
The book is Wild New World, the epic story of animals and people in America. Dan Flores is the author. The Eurasian invasion is coming again, this time from the east. The colonization of Wild New World. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
What if your top salesperson was 1,000 times more efficient? And what if a limitless digital workforce helped your number one find leads? A super team working 24/7 on their behalf. Thinking, acting, and solving complex tasks so more deals closed. What if with every sale, each customer felt like they were the only customer? That would be one very efficient sales leader. Now, imagine if every person on your team worked to the power of 1,000. They can with Agentforce, the powerful AI from Salesforce.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.